This episode of the Linux Action Show is brought to you by DigitalOcean and by Ting. Go to last.ting.com and save $25 off your first device or your first month of service.
Linux Fest Northwest 2014 in the beautiful Pacific Northwest, the 15th year of Linux Fest Northwest right here at Bellingham Technical College. My name is Chris.
My name is Matt.
Hey, Matt. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Are you ready for me to tell folks about the big show today?
I think it's time.
All right. Well, coming up on the big show this week, we are here at Linux Fest Northwest. We've been here all weekend, and we're going to give you the highlights of what we saw. We went out to the booth, talked with some folks. We're going to have some folks stop by and chat with us, and we'll give you some of our takeaway thoughts and impressions of the entire Linux Fest. And then, of course, like always, we're going to cover some news. We've got our picks, and we're going to do some giveaways in the feedback. We've got goodies right here, some swag. Ooh. We've brought some extra stuff, some books, balloons, all kinds of things. So in the feedback segment, a little bit different this week. We're going to do a giveaway. But first, Matt.
Yes.
As is tradition on the Linux Action Show, it is our picks. Woo. And this week, our Runs Linux picks is this Raspberry Pi-based smartphone. And it runs Linux. Look at this thing. Now, this isn't something you're going to take home to grandma.
Wow.
But this is pretty hardcore.
Although, it does have big numbers.
Yeah. So he went out and he got a whole sandwich setup here, all kind of stacked on top of a Raspberry Pi. And I'll walk you through this video a little bit to kind of show you. See here, he's got a video out signal too.
Right.
And he's got an audio out signal. He's got a built-in cell antenna. He's got a board there that he's sandwiched on an LCD touchscreen to.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And he's able to actually have, he has a GSM modem in this thing, and he's able to make full-on fledged freaking phone calls from a Raspberry Pi. He even sandwiched in a battery between the display and the Raspberry Pi itself, so it's fully legitimately mobile. Wherever there's GSM coverage, this guy can make phone calls on this thing. He was kind of showing off some of the software a little bit. I mean, it's no Android 4.4, but...
But, you know, I'll tell you, is it weird that I want one?
Kind of. I mean, it's a good toy, right? This is a phone where you don't have to worry about its expandability.
Is true. You can expand on it at will.
You don't have to worry about removable SD cards or anything like that. So it is limited to GSM GPRS, which means you're not going to be getting 4G speeds with this kind of thing. I don't really think that's the point. Nope. It's just pretty awesome that the whole thing works in a portable little package. I didn't catch the battery life on it.
I'm going to wager it's probably not too impressive.
Yeah, I'm going to see here. He's working on a new battery, but I didn't catch what the life of it was. And here's the great side view. You can really see, like, he's even zip tied a little bit. There's the battery pack right there. There's the LCD screen. You can see the LED lights on it. I love the fact that, by the way, he has an Ethernet port.
Seriously, this is a man that gets it, and it's almost a little bigger than my old Windows phone.
This was making kind of a splash this weekend. People were talking about this, and so I just had to make this the Runs Linux. Here's his total price. Okay, you ready for this?
Bad.
$40 for the Pi, $35 bucks for the touchscreen, $15 bucks for the battery, $48 bucks for the GSM module, $10 for a DC-DC booster converter, and then accessories, cables, and stuff like that, another $10 bucks. Total cost for his custom Raspberry Pi cell phone, $158.
Boy. You know, for that kind of price, I think I could see myself putting one of those together and having some fun.
And if you do, he's got the code up on GitHub.
Nice.
So you can just go up there and check it out and see what he's doing.
Good deal.
All right, Matt. Well, we've got a great desktop pick for anybody who's maybe considering doing some live gaming and wants to stream that. And they don't want to have to worry about Flash, Media Encoder, how the heck you're going to live stream to like a Justin or a Twitch or a Scale Engine from Linux. And there's always been a way to do it, but it's usually involved, if you really get serious about it, a lot of bash scripting to really pull this off.
Well, which is a pain.
Yeah, it's a major pain. So you caught something this week that we're going to talk about here in a little bit. But first, before we get to our picks, I want to thank our first sponsor, and that is DigitalOcean. Woo, everybody, right? Digital. Woo! We love DigitalOcean here at Linux Fest Northwest. What is DigitalOcean? Well, it's simple cloud hosting dedicated to offering the most intuitive and easy way to spin up a cloud server. Users can create a cloud server in 55 seconds. 40 seconds. Wow. Anybody here got 40 seconds? All right. Some people, 47 seconds?
Got 47. Oh, okay. That's pretty good.
All right, yeah. $5 a month is all you have to pay to get a 512 megabyte RAM, 20 gigabyte SSD, and a terabyte of transfer. That's an incredible deal, and that SSD means you can do a lot more with less, which gives you not only an incredible value, but a higher density. And DigitalOcean has data center locations in New York, San Francisco, Singapore, and Amsterdam. Their interface is simple. Their their control panel is really intuitive. And what's kind of awesome, in fact, I meant to set this aside. It was in the Linux Action Show subreddit. They have a straightforward API that is it's really kind of, some people have called it quite elegant. Well, you can see now why having an API for the dashboard is actually a really cool thing, because here is an indicator app written for the Ubuntu desktop that actually ties in with your DigitalOcean droplets. So you can see this guy's getting all of the status of his DigitalOcean droplets. He can reboot them. He can power them off. He can see if they're up or down. He gets their IP. He gets their Linux version. He gets their region and their amount of memory all in that app. Yeah, this is really cool.
Like it.
And it's called DigitalOcean Indicator. I will link to it in the show notes. There's a PPA available, and it's using that straightforward API. And DigitalOcean has a whole new class of applications that the community are building around DigitalOcean, because there's so much enthusiasm and passion for a company that is finally getting this combination of incredible performance, tier one bandwidth, awesome customer service, incredible intuitive management, and this API. It's all kind of coming together with DigitalOcean, powered by Linux.
Yes, and I love the fact that you can do it from the desktop. You never have to leave anything, go browsing somewhere.
That makes it crazy convenient and super efficient. Here's what I want you to do. Use our promo code LASTAPRIL, and you're going to get a $10 credit for DigitalOcean. And then you can go try out that $5 rig for 2 months if you want, or heck, go check out their higher powered rig and see what you can do. And something you might want to look at, they just rewrote their HTML5 console in Go.
Oh, yeah.
And they have a blog post up on their site about why they chose Go, and it's really fascinating if you're following the Go language and you have any kind of interest in it. They did a good write-up on why they chose Go. And again, I think I just want to underscore the point that they have an HTML5 console. That's pretty cool. So go to DigitalOcean.com. Use the promo code LASTAPRIL when you check out. And a really big thank you to DigitalOcean for sponsoring the Linux Action Show. Woo. All right.
All right.
So let's talk about this app that you submitted to the subreddit this week. It's called Screen Studio.
Yes.
And Screen Studio is a small tool to help you broadcast or record your desktop or screencast with a webcam overlay if you want. Kind of reminded me a little bit of Webcam Studio.
It's a little bit like Webcam Studio without the extra bloat.
It's really lean.
I was running this one on a netbook and it didn't even care.
Really?
So, yeah. I mean, it's really nice because if you're someone that's like trying to capture games, for example, or you want to stream it, you can actually have your webcam image going at the same time as you're doing whatever you're doing on your
desktop. I like this. And you can crop it in where you want it at and where you want it in the screen.
That's right.
You can set your bit rate and then
And overlays, as far as like if you want a banner at the bottom, you want a lower third. Oh, yeah. And you can customize your own.
Oh, yeah. I see that. Yeah.
Being released every single day. They're like coming up with new releases, new features, bug fixes, you know. So check it out. Frequently.
So it's a jar download.
Yes.
So just you'll have to be able to run that. But it's built around AVConf, which is awesome. It's available on all distros that have that out of the box. So pretty much as long as you have JRE7 and you've got AVConf, you're good to go. So it's called Screen Studio, and you could use this to record locally, or you could use this to broadcast out to a site. But I just like this from like, hey, you want to create a quick tutorial. Hey, you want to record yourself doing an awesome move in some game you're playing?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think Screen Studio's developer also has a G+ group if you want to check that out.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, good.
I'll link there on the page linked in the show notes, as a matter of fact.
Nice.
Very good. So that, and you can also find it at screenstudio.crombiz. That's crombz.com. I'm probably saying that right.
It sounds right to me. I have no idea. That's what I call it.
Yeah, I think so.
Pat may have another name for it.
Well, I'm not quite sure, Matt. But anyways, so go check that out. I think you guys will love it. Now, we do have one little bit of weekly spotlight. I'm not going to be able to play it for you today, but that's okay. You can go check it out on your own and maybe grab the whole album. Yes, an album is our weekly spotlight pick. You might have heard about this. A band has released their album as a kernel module.
What?
A kernel module. And they're a Seattle-based band, so it's perfect for this weekend. It's called Netcat. That's cute. Not to be confused with the networking tool, of course.
I was going
to
say.
And it's pretty neat. The way they do it is a kernel module as well as MP3 formats and things like that. Have you ever considered, they say, listening to an album and thinking, man, this sounds so good, but I wish I crossed from user space to kernel space more often? Well, they've got you covered. Their album is now fully playable as a loadable Linux kernel module. The album is called Cycles Per Instruction, and the kernel module can be found on GitHub, and they're also taking payment for like $5-$10 to get it.
Interesting.
Yep, here's the guys that make it, Brandon, David, and Andrew. Couple of classy looking dudes with some musical talents. I listened to a little bit last night. It's good, like actually for good nighttime music when you're kind of just ready to kind of kick back and maybe lay in bed and space out and fall asleep.
Very cool.
It was great for that.
Check that out.
There you go. It looks like a pretty good album, and the fact that it's a kernel module, that's the first time I've ever heard anything like that. So I was pretty darn
impressed.
That's
just trippy. I mean, when I hear that, I'm thinking, sure. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
You know,
it works though. It works. All right, Matt, let's do the news.
Hey, it's the news, and this episode is brought to you by
Ting.com. Matt Ting is mobile that makes sense. Go to last.ting.com to get started. Why would you do that? Because you are people, and people love Ting. And you can save $25 by switching to Ting if you go to last.ting.com. If you already got a phone, well, guess what? If you got like a phone you like, you can just bring it. And then Ting will give you a $25 credit for your first bill. So here's the basics about Ting. No contract, no early termination fee, and you only pay for what you use. Each line, individually, $6. You got 10 lines, $6 for each line. And then it's just your usage on top of that. You get a MiFi hotspot, you're paying $6 for that hotspot, and then it's just your usage on top of that. No contracts, no early termination fees. And by the way, an incredible dashboard where you can manage your phone, manage your services, set up options like forwarding, caller ID, nicknames for devices to make the billing simpler. And they also tie it all together with apps for iOS and Android. Plus, Ting is right now rolling out brand new devices. They're featuring their personal shopper right up in the center if you want to have them go get you a used device. They've also got feature phones if you're not really particularly needing a smartphone. And they've got, of course, the big dogs like the new Galaxy S5, the Moto X, the LG Flex. All of these, the new Note 3, are available for Ting that you own them outright. They don't use that trick where they subsidize the cost of the phone to lock you in and then sort of suck the value out of you for the next 2 years. The way they do this is by you buying this phone, you know, like every other country does it, like everywhere else in the world, by you buying this phone up front, it makes it much more valuable for you in the long run. Go over to last.ting.com and try out that savings calculator, because while you're there, you can just set your current info in there. Just plug it in and see what kind of savings you would see, and then tell me it doesn't make sense. And by the way, every Ting plan includes hotspot, tethering, caller ID, voicemail, picture messaging, standard messaging, Canadian customer support where you call them between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. and a real Canadian answers the phone, solves your problem. We've even heard stories of folks who are not Ting customers calling Ting customer service.
Wow.
Because that really, they're so much better than the other guys. Yeah, it really does say something. So go over to last.ting.com. That lets them know you heard about it right here on the Linux Action Show, and you appreciate them keeping us on the air. Last.ting.com. And a ginormously huge thank you to the great folks over at Ting.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, our first story this week, it's kind of been a light news week other than what we've got here. The main news is here at the fest.
That's right.
But we're going to get to that later in the show. However, there is something we've been talking about. We talked about a little bit on last week's Linux Action Show. We've talked about it a heck of a lot on TechSnap, and that's the whole fallout now from Heartbleed. And there's been some big movements by the Linux Foundation to form a new initiative to prevent, hopefully, future Heartbleed-type mistakes in core infrastructure code. Joining us to talk about that is our very own Mr. Alan Jude from TechSnap and BSD Now. Alan, welcome to Linux Action Show.
Thanks for having me.
So, what are your initial thoughts as, you know, a vocal BSD advocate of the Linux Foundation heading up an effort to fund development of things like OpenSSL and potentially other infrastructure projects?
It seems like a pretty good idea. What they're looking at doing is creating little slots of fellowships, they're called.
Yeah.
Where someone will basically get paid full-time to work on that code.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of an approach the FreeBSD Foundation has taken before to solve. You know, there's certain problems that if everybody has that problem, somebody's going to fix it.
Yeah.
But if it's the kind of problem where it takes an expert or it's just not work anybody would volunteer to do,
yeah,
because cleaning up that code base is not going to be fun.
Right.
Someone
said
it's
uncleanable.
It's going to be tedious and horrible job.
Yeah.
And so someone's only going to do that if they're getting paid for it.
So,
and so it come down to having a foundation to do that.
What about...
And I think, you know...
What about the fact that it's the Linux Foundation?
Right. The fact that it's the Linux Foundation has... the main thing there is if all those companies came together and tried to create a new foundation to handle that, it probably wouldn't have been as agnostic to dealing with more than one project. They would have been like, you know, just expand the OpenSSL Foundation or make a new foundation for this stuff.
And it would have taken a lot longer.
Yeah. And the corporations behind it would have maybe had too much play with it and stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas
Linux Foundation, like
you said, it would just take a very long time to set up.
Yeah.
There's a lot of paperwork and government stuff.
Right.
Whereas using an existing foundation meant that the work could start almost right away.
So we've seen also the emergence of LibreSSL from the OpenBSD camp.
Yep.
If you're a betting man, you're going to put money on one horse. Are you betting on LibreSSL at this point? Are you betting on OpenSSL?
Well, OpenSSL is what's available on every operating system right now.
Yeah.
And LibreSSL is only open
for
SSD.
Now. Yeah.
It'll be interesting seeing over the next couple of months how the progress is there towards possibly making it portable.
Yeah. So you think if
it's
work
it's
on
a little
that,
too early to tell now.
That's critical, you think?
Yeah. But, if it's only ever for OpenBSD, it's not very much use to anybody.
Right, yeah.
But I know what you mean. And it basically comes down to, do they plan to I don't know that they know the answer to this yet, but if we're going to see a portable version in 3 or 4 months, or at least the first versions of a portable version,
yeah,
then it has a good chance.
Right. But if they take
too long,
it's
going to be a year before they can start working on a portable version,
yeah,
then there's other issues.
Right.
So it'll depend. And it might come down to someone from Linux or FreeBSD or some other project that wants to use LibreSSL
right.
having to take the code from OpenBSD and start the porting process themselves.
Yeah.
Because the OpenBSD guys
are focused.
They're focused on fixing all the other problems,
yeah.
and maybe it's best
more
to let
about
them
OpenBSD.
Maybe let them focus on it
yeah.
and let the somebody more familiar with the internals of Linux
right.
focus on getting yeah. that stuff to be portable to Linux.
So, if you look into your crystal ball, do you think on TechSnap for the rest of the year we'll be covering stories related to Heartbleed? We just talked about
yeah,
it's
like
going to come
we
out.
We did episode 160,
yeah.
which will come out next week,
yeah.
Where we almost the entire episode was just things that happened because of Heartbleed.
And somehow it's some serious stuff.
Yeah, and a lot of people actually even at the conference have asked me, was Heartbleed that big of a deal
yeah.
with all the hype it got?
Yeah.
And when you watch 160, you'll understand.
Yeah.
Like, there's some serious stuff that happened here.
Yeah, and
like
stuff
we,
that...
Like, we talked about on even 158 that the Canada Revenue Agency, which is like the IRS in Canada,
right.
was Heartbleed was used against them, and 900 people's social insurance number, which is like a social security number,
right.
were stolen.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Luckily, they caught the guy, and yeah. he's already in jail.
Right, yeah, that was a pretty quick... Yeah, they got yeah. him quick. But
the Canadian government takes that kind of stuff seriously. But
And you know, what's interesting, and we talk about it more in TechSnap 160, is the ways that they're exploiting Heartbleed are not... Like, they weren't web services they went after in some cases?
Web services got all the attention in the first couple days.
Yeah.
But some of the people that... Some of the other services people didn't realize maybe were using OpenSSL, like
right.
OpenVPN.
Right.
And if OpenVPN is built into your tiny appliance,
right.
you don't know if it's using 098 or 101.
Right.
And
exactly.
then so stuff can end up happening, but you didn't know that appliance had that.
Yeah.
Or, you know... Especially in most of the cases we saw, it was a black box.
Yeah.
It was a VPN concatenator
right.
from Cisco or something,
right.
and you didn't know that it
right.
had the vulnerability.
And you might not have a support contract where you're getting updates anymore.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, some of those support contracts, if you didn't have it, you have to pay
back
for all of the time that you didn't have it
yeah.
in order to get the update.
Yeah. Well, I think it's pretty great that the Linux Foundation is working on this.
Yeah, and I'm a little surprised at the fact, like... You know, there's GNU TLS.
Yes.
And...
Right. Right.
Honestly, what I would like to see is the diversity.
Yeah.
So I would like to see the Linux Foundation fund both.
Right.
So that we always have two options.
Great point.
At least two options.
Yeah.
Because it's really bad when you get in the case of a monoculture where there's only one option.
Right. We're suffering from that right now.
Yeah. It's, OpenSSL is... GNU TLS is starting to get a little bit bigger.
Right.
I know a couple of distros are using it as the default for most things
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
But... It would be nice to see more adoption there, just so there's more diversity.
Right.
And maybe LibreSSL could be a help for that as well.
Yeah.
Although, because it's just a fork of OpenSSL, at least going forward for a while, there's a chance a bug in one is going to be a bug in the other.
Yeah, that's true,
But
too.
I imagine LibreSSL will find a lot of the bugs that are there because...
Yeah.
One of the things they're doing is actually changing all the code into kernel normal form, which is the style.
Yeah.
And changing a lot of the practices and stuff, and they'll spot a lot of the stuff. One of the biggest problems with OpenSSL is it's like 350,000 lines of code, and
they're
it's
sending
not
that back
possible
upstream?
To audit.
They're sending those changes back upstream?
No,
you know?
But they're available. It's still open source. They can't change the license.
And if
so
they find
still,
something big, it'll become public.
Yeah, it's in their commit logs. Hey, look, there's a use after free here that
yeah.
probably should have been fixed.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good to
and,
know.
And that was one of the reasons that they started the project even before Heartbleed, right?
Yeah.
LibreSSL
right.
was started before Heartbleed.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Because on OpenBSD, the memory allocator overwrites memory when you free it. If OpenSSL hadn't had its own custom memory allocator
right.
and used the one from the operating system,
right.
OpenBSD wouldn't have been vulnerable to Heartbleed and every other OS would have been.
Right.
Because they don't do that.
Right.
But there's a countermeasure almost in OpenSSL that made that not work.
Yeah.
And... They started investigating why, and they're like,
this
why
is
this like this?
Yeah.
And so they decided that
we're gonna
maybe
make
they
something ourselves.
Need to maybe they need to fix some of that stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Maybe it didn't have to be a fork, but they were going to fix that stuff.
Right.
And then it just went further, and they're like, well, yeah, now we're committed to doing this.
Yeah, well, and it, I mean, they're a good team to do it, but I'm like yeah. you said, I'm glad to see the diversity.
And yeah, I want to see the diversity, so it seems like OpenSSL is going to get lots of money now because they have Google yep. and Dell and Apple yeah. and everybody.
Yeah.
So maybe yeah. some people should look at donating to the OpenBSD Foundation to
Libre SSL. It's Google, Intel, Microsoft, NetApp, Qualcomm, wow. VMware, and a couple others in the Linux Foundation.
Amazon,
yeah,
Amazon, and a couple other places, yeah.
Yeah. So it's a big group, and it's kind of funny because it's the group I was on air being like, these guys need to come together because they're making a ton of money off the back of OpenSSL, yeah. and they need to put their money where their mouth is, and that's exactly what's
happening. Well, it's nice when they listen to you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Yeah. You're welcome, everybody.
It works for me.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Alan. Well, thanks for stopping by and chatting with us about this. It's if you haven't watched recent episodes of TechSnap on this topic, this is TechSnap's wheelhouse, and 160 yep. just rocks it with a lot of heartbleed follow-up, and that'll be up this Thursday that we're recording this.
Yep.
All right, Alan. We'll have a great rest of the fest. You're going to go catch yeah. a ZFS talk now?
Yes, I am.
All right. Good.
Thanks for stopping by. Yep.
You can run that talk, Alan.
Well, no, it's about using ZFS on Linux, which is something I need to learn a little bit about.
Oh, good.
Oh,
yes.
Very
well,
cool.
No joke. We go to the after party last night, right. and people keep coming up to Alan during the after party, like asking him ZFS questions.
I like ZFS.
So, like, I'm walking through the museum, and I'll just randomly hear something from Alan, and I'll hear Zed just thrown out, like, ZFS, Zed. It's like, oh, Alan's still talking about ZFS. And then we were all ready to leave. We were waiting outside, and we're like, where's Alan? And I'm like, oh, he's just probably wrapping up a ZFS conversation. And he was.
I was. And looking for cookies.
Yeah. Good. All right, Alan. Well, enjoy the talk, and let us know how it was, okay?
Yep.
Very good. In fact, later on today, we're going to be giving away some stuff, so stick Ooh. Around.
Yes, we got some BSD stuff to
yes,
give away.
And exactly.
some,
I want you here if you can be for that. Yes. We'll be later on. So
The D-Trace book is OS agnostic. It covers Linux, Solaris,
nice.
And FreeBSD.
Right.
And then the other one is the Absolute OpenBSD. So if you've ever, you know, people have heard a lot about OpenBSD recently, especially with all the code is audited and they're making these changes to OpenSSL.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to learn how to do it, that's the very best book to do it with.
We'll be giving that away today. All right, very good. Well, our last news story for the week is something that's just kind of cool that caught my attention because there's a 3D printer here at the fest that they're showing off. The Maker Faire is getting set up. It is a do-it-yourself Google Glass.
Whoa.
This is, now, of course, not quite on feature parity of Google Glass, but essentially what you do is you take a Raspberry Pi or another type of device. He's got it in his pocket, and it runs up to a display system. The thing that's neat about this is the entire housing is available online as a 3D print thing that you can download and print out the housing for it. He supplies an electronics kit, so you can then just plug in your electronics. A lot of DIY. You got to do some soldering
sure.
here. But at the end of the day, you get a Raspberry Pi-powered version of Google Glass. And there's the 3D printed case
that
with the lens.
Awesome.
It comes with two lenses, but only one's used at a time. That's for backup. And it kind of looks exactly like Google Glass when all's said and done. It
looks like if you have an existing pair of glasses, whether they actually have lenses or not, it's up to you. You can just wire those on. You're good to go.
Yeah, Noah is here, part of our crew, and he's wearing Google Glass. And everywhere we've gone, it has been a big deal, and the ladies love it.
Oh yeah,
I'm not trying to get Noah in trouble.
The ladies are all about.
I don't want Noah to
Glass.
Get in trouble, but the lady. Am I right? Don't the ladies love it? I know they love it. They love the Google Glass. So
nice.
I'm just saying that might be $1,500 well spent, depending on your situation.
This is true. You know? Look into it.
All right, Matt. That's all the news for this week. So we're here at Linux Fest Northwest. We've been here all weekend, 2014 edition, 15th year of Linux Fest Northwest in the beautiful Pacific Northwest, Bellingham, Washington, Technical College, Linux Action Show, Linux Unplugged booth. We've seen hundreds and hundreds of people. I think attendance this year was around more than 1,300. Mm. It's just been a banner year for Linux Fest Northwest. Before we get into some of our favorite things, I really want to thank our segment sponsor, System76, creators of machines born to run Ubuntu. They've got so many great desktops and laptops. And Matt and I are extremely fortunate because this weekend they hooked us up with some machines that we could use for the fest. I've got the Ultra Pro. You guys know I've been wanting this one so bad. This Ultra Pro has been so handy to be able to carry around, the battery life, taking it back to the hotel last night and be able to prep the show, not having to worry about, carrying something between the conference floor and the hotel room and transportation of all of that. And Matt has been able to rock some video games on the Benobes.
I'll tell you, I've been rocking games on this. I mean, like, I'm getting nothing done and it's great. I love everything about that.
Yeah.
It's been awesome.
And what was really great is we kind of figured out a little trick yesterday when things were thinning out and we wanted to draw people to the booth. We started gaming and we had it up on a TV behind us, and both of these machines are able to deliver such beautiful graphics that people would just stop and sort of be in awe of what they were watching and then start talking with us. And it really was an interesting and great way to kind of spark a dialogue. So go over to system76.com, get a machine that's designed to run Linux. That way you stop fighting with your hardware and you can start having fun with your Linux. Right. And I can't tell you how important it is to have a complete total user experience when you're switching someone to Linux. When they have a machine that they genuinely just love, it helps them move into a new operating system. And System 76 is that full end-to-end product that does that. So system76.com. Tell them the Linux Action Show sent you. We'd really appreciate it. So we've got a list of stuff that from Linux Fest Northwest that I want to start with. First things first, we got our hands on right away. Totally unexpected. I never expected to get this here. When I was thinking of everything that might happen at Linux Fest Northwest, this never crossed my mind. We got to play with the new Valve controller.
Yes.
It wasn't the most recent iteration, but it was awesome. I played Team Fortress with it, and one of the things that I haven't really fully grokked until I held one, first of all, extremely comfortable to hold. It is very comfortable to hold. Second thing, they have micro pistons under each nipple area of the controller that fire at the back of the pad that give you a sensation localized to where your finger's on that controller. And the trigger fingers are very comfortable. I am really excited now about the Valve controller. So that was really awesome. And there's a few other things that we ran into, but I wanted to bring on one of the guys that's been part of our crew. He's been absolutely instrumental in helping us get pulled all of this off. He was here last year, too. His name's Noah. Noah, welcome to Linux Action Show.
Well, thanks, Chris. Like you said, we had a chance to get out on the floor and talk to a couple different people and shake some hands.
Yeah.
And I think the first one that you wanted to talk about was TrueAbility, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, these guys are sitting right across from us, right? Is this these guys here or those guys?
Nope, the guys right across from the booth.
So what are they about? What are they doing?
So essentially what TrueAbility does is they have crafted a online model for testing. So you're an enterprise or you're an employer and you are looking to screen potential candidates for a position that opened up.
Yeah.
And so you say, you know, what's the best way to do that? And so, you know, the traditional wisdom says, well, I can publish an online test, I give a written test, or I do an interview. But a lot of that's wasted time because you don't know what that candidate's actually going to do in the field. How do they perform?
So are these scenario tests?
Yeah, right. So they'll give you a server and they'll set it up and they'll say, I want you to deploy a LAMP stack so the technology is based on whatever's in your environment. So So you have a Red Hat server and you say, we want to we're looking for somebody to manage our DNS. Well, then they're going to set up, a DNS stack and say,
that's
configure
awesome.
The server to do DNS.
And
that's
then what? Cool.
Yeah, and what they do is they actually not only keep track in a point system, they also screenshot the entire segment. So as an employer, when I go
you
to
can review it.
Yeah, right. So I go to look at my candidates and I go, these guys scored really well. Now I can click on that and I can actually review the footage.
Oh, wow. So you can see exactly where they hung up and whatnot.
Or they do it this way. Yeah. I'm going to make them know that I want this guy, but I'm going to tell them, really around here we do it this way.
So you had a chat with them?
Yeah. All right. We had a long chat.
Let's throw to the interview with them. This is Noah at their booth.
We're here with Luke, and he is the CEO of TrueAbility. How are you doing today, Luke?
Very good, Noah. Thanks for speaking with me today.
Happy. Thank you for speaking with us. Can you tell me a little bit about what TrueAbility is and what it provides to your customers?
Sure. TrueAbility is, we like to think of it as a server playground for Linux professionals. The technology we built is called Ability Screen. Mm-hmm. What Ability Screen is, it provisions a live server in the cloud, and it allows tech pros to log into it and demonstrate their skills in a live environment. Mm-hmm. Now, companies use that to screen candidates. So when a candidate applies to a job, rather than looking at paper or rather than asking them interview questions over the phone, we have candidates log into a real server and prove that they have the skills to do the job. IT professionals use Ability Screen to learn new technologies. They can log into our environment, learn new technologies like SaltStack. Maybe they've used Puppet, maybe they use Chef, but never been exposed to a technology like SaltStack. We will have an LED article about what is SaltStack, how is it used, and then invite the IT professional to log into a real server and actually apply what they just learned. And we also do skills competitions. Next week, starting Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the 28th to 30th, we're running Linux Showdown 7. That's one that a lot of people see ads on Facebook about. This is a competition where we have, on average, about 1,000 Linux professionals from across the U.S., across the world, log in and compete to fix the broken server the fastest. And the winners from those competitions compete for different prizes that we give away each day.
Now, that sounds really interesting, because even if I'm not working in the enterprise space, you're saying there's still a benefit to your site demonstrating my ability or perhaps acquiring that ability. Do you have a way for people that use your site to acquire a new skill or an ability?
Yeah, so a big part of this, what we're building out right now, is our learning and development piece. Over the past year, we've been really focused on employers and helping them screen candidates. But what we're building now is what we're calling our true ability profiles and self-assess. You could come in and learn a new technology. Start playing around with it on a playground server, and then take a self-assessment and earn a badge on True Ability. That's something we're really excited about. It's coming out next month. We want to be the professional resume for Linux professionals. We want, when they apply to a job, to apply not just with their resume, but their True Ability profile that proves the skills that they have.
Now, from an enterprise standpoint, if I am going to interview my candidates, so I do I just get a score sheet? I mean, how do I really know that score represents the skill I'm looking for? Is there any way for me to look at the performance that my potential employee did in a little bit more depth, other than just numbers on a sheet?
Yeah, so it's definitely more than just numbers on a sheet. One of the cool things we do is we provide a video playback of the shell session. So the hiring teams, the folks making the technical hiring decisions, can actually not just see the score. They can go see each task that we ask them to do, whether they successfully completed or not. We go and check the end state of the server, if the server was properly configured correctly, and we provide a video playback of that shell session so you can see exactly how they do that. Now, the other cool thing we do is, what does that score mean? If someone scores a 67% on the assessment, what does it mean? And there's a couple ways you can interpret that. One, some companies will go and assess their internal employees first, and then we can do percentile ranking. So we can rank, how does this candidate compare to my current staff? Or we also allow you to do percentile ranking across our user community. We have close to 8,000 users that have taken assessments to True Ability. So when you take an assessment, or if you screen a candidate, you can actually see how they compare to the others that have taken this similar assessment to get a real good idea of how talented that candidate really is.
That sounds like you're providing a really excellent service and a very needed service too. I mean, I was talking with Alan Jude from the BSD project, and he was, or PCBSD, and he was talking about how they have tried to develop a similar infrastructure. And he said, I took one look, and I'm like, this is it. This is what we're looking for. So, where can people go to find out more about True Ability, or to sign up to enter into one of these competitions, or to test their skills out?
Yeah, so you just go to trueability.com, sign up for free as a tech professional. A great way to experience our platform is to participate in the showdown next week. For employers, you just click post a job, and one of our account managers are great to help you out over the phone, build a custom assessment for you, or use pre-configured assessments that we already have. It's real easy to try out.
Thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us.
Thank you, Noah.
So, that was really great. Now, one of the things that people stopped by and showed me that I've been pretty surprised with is there's a lot of Chromebooks, but here at Linux Fest, you wouldn't be too surprised to learn a lot of them are dual booting.
Of course, obviously. Yeah.
One of the ways they're doing this is with something brand new called Crouton, and it's not technically a dual boot anymore. It's a cheroot environment inside Chrome OS, where you can run a full-fledged Linux distribution, and all you need is a key combo in Chrome OS to swap between your Chrome installation and your Linux installation. And I had a couple people stop by the booth.
Nice.
They were showing me their ability to swap. A lot of them are running Ubuntu, because that way they could get touch on those Chromebooks.
Makes
so
sense.
This is Crouton Chrome OS Universal Cheroot Environment. I think we might be taking a look at this in the future. It was a pretty cool tool, and it looked really seamless. And I asked them about performance and things like that. I'm like, yeah, you know, Chromebooks are a little tight on memory, but it works. At the end of the day, it actually works.
Is this something you would run on your own?
I'm thinking about setting up my... So you'd have to... The way you'd have to do it is you go Chrome OS, you wipe that, So I'd have to wipe my Linux installation, sure, go back to Chrome OS, enter developer mode, and then you install this,
okay,
you're good to go. So it's pretty
Seems
cool.
reasonable.
Yeah, all right. So, Noah, you had a chance to talk with the guys over at Linode, right?
That's right.
How was their booth?
Yeah, so their booth was a little bit scaled down from last year. They didn't have a demo machine showing what their dashboard looked like.
Is that because it was on Macs last year?
That's right. Yeah, and I told him that I was very happy about that. But I think the most exciting thing was that they offer Arch installs.
Oh,
so, yeah. So you lost your Arch on DigitalOcean.
Yeah, you can get it on Linode.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
So we had a chance to talk to them, and they had some very interesting things to say. We're here with Matt today from Linode. Matt, how are you doing today?
Good. Yourself?
Pretty good. Now, the first thing I noticed about the Linode table, different from last year, is that you're not demoing it on a Mac. Now, it's not, don't get me wrong, it's not that I don't like Mac. Mm-hmm. I can't stand them. So the fact that you guys didn't bring an iMac here today to Linux Fest makes me very, very happy. Aside from the iMac situation, though, what can you tell me about what Linode's doing and the changes that Linode's making, where we are and where we've been from last year?
Well, we are now offering SSDs. That's actually a thing that we released as of a week ago. New plans, which double the RAM. We now do hourly billing, so you can spin up something for a couple hours if you need to, or if you hit a monthly, the end of the month, you'll just pay the monthly rate. That's about all I can think of right now.
No, that's awesome. And I was talking to Q5 Sys, and he was telling me that you guys are offering Arch as an installation medium for the Linode servers. Now, that is, I think, particularly appealing to the Jupyter Broadcasting audience because they tend to be on the bleeding edge of things, right? So what can you tell me from a support standpoint? I mean, that must be, crazy to support or to keep that updated and working.
I mean, we keep our images updated. We update them, usually shortly after a new release comes out. As far as support-wise goes, we'll definitely support. We'll try to assist you with whatever problems you have. But primarily, we handle network and hardware. But yeah, definitely, if you have any questions, anything like that, you can always open up a ticket or give us a call. So.
And I've used Linode for years for clients and things like that. And so you guys have clearly established yourself in the enterprise from a reliability standpoint. But what can you tell me about the cost effectiveness? What can I start if I just want to play with the Linode? What would it cost me to get started on renting a virtual server?
Well, lowest monthly plan is $20 per month, 2 gigs of RAM, 3 terabytes of transfer. 48 gigs of disk space, it's all on SSDs now. So, that's the monthly cost. That's 3 cents per hour if you wanted to spin up, for a couple hours or even a couple days. That's...
The majority of the, speaking to the internal workings of your company, if you can share this, what would you say are most people that work at the office, are they running Linux as a desktop OS, or is it primarily Windows or Mac, and we're just providing the service for Linux?
Just about all of us run some sort of Linux server somewhere, whether it's at home or even on a Linode. So, yeah, we're all pretty well-versed in Linux. We kind of use whatever we want at home, but as far as in the office, it's mainly Macs.
Okay, yeah, you have to use the tools that work for you, right?
Hey, it works.
All right, well, thank you very much for your time. I should ask, if anyone wanted to start or get more information on Linode, where could they go or find more information?
Linode.com has everything, pricing, about us, whatever you'd like to look at. Or if you can't find anything there, you can always send us an email, support@linode.com, or give us a call. Phone number's also on the website. I don't remember.
One of the folks that stopped by is the Red Hat booth folks. They are talking a lot this week about Project Atomic, which works in conjunction with Linux containers. Right now, they're focused on Docker, and what the idea is, it's a way to deploy and manage containers on Linux. Red Hat's all about this, and one of their guys that's working on it stopped by to chat with us. Welcome to the Linux Action Show live at Linux Fest Northwest.
Thank you.
So tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Brian Proppitt. I'm the community manager for Project Atomic and Overt at Red Hat.
Well, I just saw the Project Atomic got a big mention in Red Hat's recap of Red Hat Summit.
Yeah.
That was a good piece. So what's Project Atomic up to?
Well, Project Atomic is the open source community upstream for what will be RHEL 7 Atomic Host that's coming out later this year. Basically what it is you have containers now, which are becoming very big in the DevOps world.
Sure.
And And as cool as Docker is and some of the other container systems out there, there's not a lot of management around them.
Mm-hmm.
So what Project Atomic hopes to be is sort of like a place, you know, a platform where you can get some kind of management and security tools sort of thrown in.
So would there be a user front end to this where I would maybe pick a container?
Yeah. So we don't have... When we get some things together, because this is very early in the mm-hmm. process,
sure.
what we'll be doing is, so you'll be able to use tools like Cockpit, which will handles like container orchestration.
Okay.
Gear D, which we're pulling in upstream from OpenShift, and it does gear management and container management.
So you're at a projectatomic.io, correct?
That's correct.
Great looking site. So if I'm, is this a server side technology always? Is this something that could be used in mobile? Is this something that could be used on the desktop? Or is this something you guys are thinking massive density server deployments? We want to install the same application in the same environment across 200 servers.
I don't think it's going to be terribly limited by, you know, where you want to put it. Obviously, with RHEL 7, it's going to be sort of geared towards the server end.
Right.
But not necessarily. I mean, I can run... We have a virtual machine now that's running off of a Fedora-based, operating system. So I can run
That's
it
what
and
I was
sort
thinking,
of do
yeah.
it locally.
Yeah.
If I were, you know, a single developer and I wanted to use containers in my development,
How does Project Atomic differ, because I'm not very familiar with either, how does it differ from Doku and things like that that also sort of use Docker to deploy applications?
So Docker is an upstream for us.
Yeah.
So that's just one of the technologies that we're consuming.
Ah, okay.
Along with RPM
OS3.
So
you're not Docker specific necessarily.
No. I mean, right now we are, because that's like, we had to pick one. So we decided, let's go with Docker because everybody knows Docker.
Yeah.
It's a really great tool.
Yeah.
But we're not being snobby or anything like
sure.
that. We're just, you know, that's the one we picked first. We go with one first.
Yeah.
So we're a consumer of them. We're a consumer of Gear D. We're a consumer of RPM OS3, which is actually where the Atomic name comes from.
Okay.
You know, because that allows you to, you can deploy things as Atomic images instead of as individual RPMs.
Right. I like that.
Yeah.
I'm not a close follower of Red Hat, but I've been a customer and I've followed them for years as part of my job. And I wonder, Red Hat seems to really have been a lot about virtualization over the last few years to me. Virtualization, not that they're not now, but it seems like all of a sudden containers, like Red Hat's just talking a lot about that at
right.
once almost. It seems like almost out of nowhere, and that's not a bad thing, but it seems like it just hit all of a sudden. Is that my mistaken impression, or is that sort of like all of a sudden as part of RHEL 7, you guys are just sort of making a big statement there?
I think it's been a long time in coming. I mean, one of the things that Paul Cormier, you know, talked about in his keynote and even after the fact was that, you know, this has been a long time in coming. Yes, we've been doing, talking about virtualization a lot. And certainly, you know, the other project that I work with, which is Overt, is all about virtualization.
Yeah.
So that's still very much there. But, you know, the groundwork that we've been doing for containers, you know, we announced a container certification program back in, what was it? I want to say December or January.
Yeah.
You know,
but still fairly recently, though.
Exactly. It's been, right. So it's not like hyper new, but
yeah.
I would say that we've been working on RPM OS3. That's something that's sort of inside Red Hat it's open source, but there's a team that's really committed to it. That's been going on for a year or two.
Okay.
You know, so
and it seems
it's
like
been
a natural
there,
evolution
just sort
of
building to it.
It seems like a natural evolution of a
right.
really strong virtualization product line, anyways.
Yeah.
So, how you say it's in Red Hat Enterprise Linux 7? How does that? And I know this might be a little bit outside your wheelhouse, but if I'm a CentOS user, what kind of expectations am I going to have there for support with Atomic and CentOS?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that Project Atomic is going to be kind of doing, because CentOS helps projects like Atomic and Overt and RDO and Glusser and because it is enterprise level Linux that, you know, is not necessarily commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Because Overt runs great, for instance, and I'm kind of backing up to something, a wheelhouse that I do know. Mm-hmm. Overt runs wonderfully on Fedora, mm-hmm. but Fedora changes. Mm-hmm. That's the nature of Fedora. Mm-hmm. It changes a lot faster
right.
than the RHEL or CentOS derivations. So, you know, these projects benefit from CentOS. And so project, because it's more stable, mm-hmm. and that I believe that Project Atomic will benefit in exactly the same way.
So in theory, I could take advantage, likely, of Project Atomic on a CentOS installation
right.
that's based on Red Hat Enterprise 7.
Right. I mean, we don't have any installable software now. Right okay. now we have a Fedora-based virtual machine that oh, okay. you can kind of download yeah. and play around with it
yeah.
that's available on the website that you mentioned.
Yep.
Very soon we're going to have a CentOS base image, which
oh, okay.
will be similar.
Cool.
And then eventually what we're trying to do, because of RPM OS 3, we've got to do some, you know, work in Anaconda and get it installable.
Yeah.
So you can install using tools, the current RPM tools, but also you can install software using RPM OS 3. And we got to bake that into a Conda and Anaconda, and then that
right.
will sort of have a...
So it'll be part of the installation
a
process.
A thing to download and install.
Wow, that'll be very cool.
Yeah, it will be.
Yeah, so...
We're in early days, so, you know, we're sort of like, ooh, come play with it.
Do you feel like containers are a huge part of the future success story of Linux in high-density solutions? Like, I think of the guys over at the Linode booth there, or one of our sponsors, DigitalOcean, who just, they deploy a lot of servers at scale for customers, and it seems like... well, now currently those solutions are virtualized based.
Right.
It seems like the ability to offer a specific application within a container could add a whole new level of density to these types of solutions. Is that why Red Hat's talking about this now? Is you guys see that as a big growth area?
You know, I'm not on the commercial side or the marketing side because, you know, I'm out in the community. But I really do think that Red Hat's overall goal
yeah.
With respect to this is to provide a solution that for anybody who wants to mess around or well actually not mess around but actually be in the cloud
right
you know and whether it's a virtual data center with no elasticity which is overt whether it's something like OpenStack based like RDO whether it's container based
mm-hmm.
you know this is all you know this is all around the operating system you still have RHEL underneath that's running you know running down there and providing the stable platform but now it's like any story you want to tell in the cloud
mm-hmm.
you know that's where however you want to live there you're going to have the opportunities and I think containers wow. because of DevOps because of agile programming containers are a really interesting
yeah.
story
yeah.
and I think Red Hat is you know introducing this to the world as something
right.
that they want to be a part of.
It's fascinating because I could see how containers could be great on a Fedora development workstation where
mm-hmm.
a developer is on his laptop or she is on her laptop and they're creating something and they take that container and they move it up on a massive server with, you know, dozens of cores. And it's, you can see how there's a place for that kind of technology at every level of the stack.
Right.
It's really interesting.
And the Fedora team's been doing awesome work working with this technology, Project Atomic, and just Docker technology in general.
Yeah.
They've made a really great commitment. And we're excited to be working with the CentOS team as well on
cool.
this as well. So
very good. Well, thanks for stopping by and chatting
with us. I really
us.
Appreciate the time.
And make
thank
sure you,
you
grab a sticker, okay?
I will grab a sticker. Thank
yeah.
you.
All right.
Gentlemen, thanks. I'm
thanks.
A big fan of the show.
Oh, great.
Appreciate
yeah,
it.
All right.
So much.
Have a great
thank
rest of your
you.
Fest.
You. All right.
We're doing the show here live tomorrow if you want to join
yeah.
us.
Thank you very much.
All right. Have a
thanks.
Good one. That was neat. You know, I'm a big,
yeah.
I'm fascinated by these container solutions because that would have solved some problems for me back in my IT days.
Oh, I imagine.
Especially with security considerations, but also just for a while, you know, just being able to snapshot something inside its own container, even if the base OS is moving around, just right. from like a server standpoint, not even from like application development standpoint, but just from having something reliable and stable, you could see how you could have a much more fluid underlying operating system if your CUPS installation and your Samba installation and your Bind installation are in these separated containers where their base systems don't change.
Makes sense.
So you could be updating all of your userland applications. You could be on an Archbox doing daily updates, but the things in these containers stay the same.
Gotta love that.
It's pretty crazy. Okay. Now, you wouldn't believe it if you weren't actually here, but one of the booths drawing the most attention, one of the companies contributing the most money to Linux Fest as a sponsor and to the after party is Microsoft. Microsoft is giving out cotton candy. They're giving out swag like crazy. They're talking to folks. Noah, you had a chance to talk to him. What was the vibe at the Microsoft booth?
Well, Chris, I thought that Microsoft actually entered into this into the community like a true community member. I know that there might be a little bit of a black cloud around them, but when I was talking to the representative, at least at the table, you know, he was very positive about wanting to be involved in the open source community. And it was funny, they actually gave out little WD-40 squirt cans. and the joke was, yeah, they want to grease their movement into the open source community.
Clever.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Okay. And then actually Chris and I ran into him at the hotel then. And we had a chance to take a look at the Windows Phone that the Microsoft rep had, and again he was a very personable guy.
Yeah, they were very cool. So why don't we roll our chat with the Microsoft booth?
Cool. We're here with Brian from Microsoft. How are you doing today, Brian?
Good. How are you?
Excellent. Can you tell me a little bit about what Microsoft is doing at Linux Fest?
Well, we're here to talk about Windows Azure. My group, Microsoft Open Technologies, is. We primarily focus on making things work on Windows, Azure, and devices. And by things, I mean open source software, technologies, and we work with communities, open source communities, to help them get your stuff on Azure. So the whole idea is if you've got a package or you've got some service or a product that is open source, there's no reason why it shouldn't run on Azure. If it runs on the cloud, it should run on Windows Azure. Even if it doesn't run on the cloud, we can help you make it run on Windows Azure. So we also work with devices, so not just Windows Phone, but iOS, Android phones as well. We help enable people to make things that work on iOS and Android work on the cloud in general. So we have a lot of services on Windows Azure that allow you to do things like mobile broadcasting, streaming media, things like this, and we help an open source package get hooked into those things so they can easily start doing those sort of things with their applications.
Now, the back end of Microsoft Azure, is that running on a Windows infrastructure or on a Linux infrastructure?
It's actually running on both. So you can run it on either Windows or Linux. We have cloud platforms, virtual machines that run both. But it, you know, it's a version of Windows that we have running at the bottom layer. And then on the top layer, we have Linux farms, we have Windows farms, all kinds of things that that are enabled to run. We have five versions of Linux. Actually, people don't know this, but 20% of Azure instances are Linux.
Really? Yeah, that is interesting, and I wouldn't have guessed that. Now, my understanding of Azure previously, and granted, I'm not very well versed in it, but my understanding was that it was essentially Microsoft's answer to like Google Drive, cloud storage. It sounds like it's much, much more than that.
Oh yeah, so much more than just storage and backup and stuff. You're talking about whole servers now. So we have three layers. You got infrastructure as a service, which is virtual machines. You got platform as a service, which is a virtual machine, but sandboxed a little, so we're managing your operating system and stuff, and you can focus on your apps. And then we have software as a service, which is websites, Joomla, Drupal, WordPress, PHP, Node, this kind of thing, and now Java as well. We're running Java in the website. So all you need to do there is bring your application and run it on top of whatever platform you choose. So we have a lot of different things. And like I said, we also have these building blocks that we put together, services like HD Insight and the mobile services, as I mentioned earlier. We have NoSQL services. So we have Cloudant, which is a CouchDB provider, and we have MongoLab, which is a MongoDB provider. You can do one-click install, setup, and both instances, by the way, have free options. So you can get started for free on a shared instance, and then if you need more, you can go to a dedicated instance as well. So that's the kind of thing. We're trying to make services and products that are open source, run on any background, any back-end system, work on Azure, and not just work on Azure, make them easier to use on Azure than any other cloud platforms. So,
outstanding. And if I was interested in setting up one of these free instances or learning more about Azure, where would I go or where could I get more information about that?
Oh, it's azure.microsoft.com.
Outstanding. Well,
There's a free trial there. You can have you give it to you $150 in credits, which is actually pretty hard to spend. I think it's 30 days. So 30 days, $150 in credits. And you can play around with any of the Windows Azure tools and gallery images. We call them gallery images, which are these pre-configured images that we have for virtual machines that you can use. And any of the software, Drupal, WordPress, things like this, which are just one-click installs. And also, my group is Microsoft Open Technologies, is msopentech.com. That's where we talk about open source and we talk about all the different packages and projects we work with. So, yeah.
Well, outstanding. Well, it's really exciting to see Microsoft starting to get into the open source world, and you know, as the WD-40 pen would imply, you know, grease the transition. And thank you very much for your time.
All right. Well,
appreciate having you.
Whenever you're at a big convention like this, one of the things you really struggle with is the Wi-Fi. Now, they've done pretty good this year. It's not perfect. It's really hard to make it perfect. And one of the reasons it's really hard to make Wi-Fi in a big event like this perfect is because you can have theories all day long about how your Wi-Fi should be set up, how your network should be arranged. But at the end of the day, if you can't throw some test load on it, you're not really going to be able to perform as expected because you've... Until you put it in production, it just never behaves like you expect. No, you stop by the booth. What are they called, and what are they doing?
So Candela Networks was here, and like you said, they had a booth. And what they do is they manufacture equipment to test network loads. And I got to tell you, Chris, having worked in enterprise networks for the majority of my adult life, the stuff that they're making would be phenomenally useful.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and the nice thing is it's based in Linux. It runs on Linux. Mm-hmm. It works with Linux. And the owner of the company is a big Linux user himself. Out of all the presentations I saw here today, out of all the people we interviewed, that was by far my favorite booth.
Yeah, very cool. So let's take a look at our chat with Candela. Let's take our chat look with Candela folks and see what they're rocking.
We're here with Ben from Candela Technology, and Ben is here with some really interesting Linux-based devices that allow him and the customers that he serves to do network testing. How are you doing today, Ben?
I'm good, thank you.
Ben, can you tell me a little bit about exactly what these boxes are and what exactly they do?
Okay, so this is a wireless station emulator system. It's a traffic generator. It's typically used to load test wireless networks and to see how they perform under load, as well as testing any network equipment that is attached to that, such as firewalls and routers, switches, etc. So this wireless station emulator is connected to an RF attenuator. This programmatically weakens the RF signal to basically emulate distance as a user may walk from an access point and away from it. So the farther it goes, the weaker the signal gets. We can emulate that all in this little piece of equipment. This equipment is running an Arduino controller with some special Arduino software on it and a little bit of a hardware board that basically breaks out its pins and connects them to some third-party attenuator modules. So we built this, and it's controlled with our main system here using Linux. We also have an access point emulator up here. Typically, our customers do not use this as an access point, but we do support that. All this is running on Fedora 19 Linux currently, and basically any other Linux of that nature. And that's pretty much it. We've been in business for 13 years or so, and been selling wireless stuff for about 5 years. And aside from that, we do normal wired Ethernet traffic generation and network emulation, so impairment testing, basically.
Now, you said that this is running Fedora. I assume that you're not talking about the actual operating system of the device. You're talking about the host operating system for the software that you're using to talk to the device. Is that correct?
Actually, both. We are running Fedora 19 Linux on our system. We have a slightly modified kernel, and we have a user space application which does the interesting work. We are actually running Fedora on our controller box as well. That's just purely a coincidence. This software will run on Microsoft or Sun or Mac or anywhere. It's just a Java application.
And if people were interested, where could they go to get more information about your company and where to buy these products?
Probably the best is just to hit our website, which is CandelaTech.com, which is CandelaTech.com. And we'll take it from there.
I think I've been doing Linux Fest Northwest for at least 13 of the 15 years, and this has been the most exciting, the most fun, the biggest crowd I've ever seen. Matt, what are your impressions just sort of sitting here now? It's coming towards the end of Sunday.
Well, for me, it's been interesting because I started out as representing Locker Gnome before, and then previous to that, I also did a couple presentations. And nowadays, I'm actually here as more of a community participant. And it's really awesome to see it grow as it has.
It's really changed
over the years. So, yeah, I'm pretty excited about
it. Change for the better, you think?
Change for the better. I think the fact that we're getting the word out about Linux, I'm no longer running into the questions I used to get. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, trying to present like Linspire and Xandros and trying to tell people why this is compelling and why it's great to use these things. And compared to what we have now, it's amazing how things have evolved. And the troubleshooting issues are lesser than they
used to. It is really funny. Like, definitely for many years, the thing was like getting computers set up with projectors. Yes. There's all that kind of stuff.
I remember that very clearly.
You know, Alan said something to me yesterday because he goes to a lot of cons, and he said that this is one of the most user-focused conventions he's ever been to. And I tend to agree with that. It really has a sense of community. The size is such that everybody sort of has a social responsibility to be polite to each other because you're going to bump into that person again this weekend. So everybody's nice.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody's friendly. And something that just I sort of realized last night as I was laying in bed, and I'm wondering if you've picked up on this.
Okay.
There is a huge elephant in the room that nobody's talking about. Nobody is mentioning the word Ubuntu or Canonical.
It's interesting.
There's no representation here at all.
Well, I think there was an actual community, maybe one of the user groups down that direction. Yeah,
there's absolutely users.
But nothing official.
Right, there's absolutely users. Some people are, it's funny, it's kind of one of those things where like, I'm using Unity. And I'm not trying to pick on Ubuntu here with this. This is just, it was sort of, Ubuntu used to be the presence that was felt.
Right.
And this weekend I realized that I haven't even really heard anybody talking about it.
No, this is true. Yeah,
there's really no representation at all.
Last year there was.
Absolutely users of it. And I think that's too bad. I because Fedora's here, OpenSUSE is here, Corora's here. There's a lot of folks from different Linux distributions that are here. And the thing is when you're not here, you're not part of the dialogue and the discussion. So when solutions are being kicked around, using the Ubuntu solution for that problem isn't even a consideration because there's nobody here kind of bringing that forward of mind, right? You're thinking of the SUSE way or how you're doing on a Raspberry Pi or what the Red Hat guys might think about that or all that kind of stuff. I thought that was just an interesting observation. I don't think it really means anything much larger than...
Yeah, I definitely felt a lesser presence. Like I said, there is a... And I don't know if it's a community user group or whatever it is, but there was an Ubuntu bannered booth over that direction.
Yeah.
I don't know what they represent, but...
Well, there's always... they've been here last year, too. They're a local lug.
But nothing corporate. Nothing from Canonical at all or anything like that.
Yeah. So. And, you know, the flip side is Red Hat sent a few folks out and SUSE sent a few folks out. So
More official versus unofficial. It's a definite parallel.
And that's sort of the track that they've been taking for the last few years, but I feel like now it's sort of getting to the point where they probably shouldn't be ignoring this event because it's pretty big now.
It's a mistake. I think it's a huge mistake. It's one that I know, like with System 76, they were adamant about making sure they were represented here. You know that they were being represented. So it would be nice to see other people that are also using Ubuntu and get the same job.
It's definitely not like it's too late or anything. Because hey, how many of you guys are running Ubuntu? How many of you guys run Ubuntu? Show of hands. 1, 2. 3, 4. So we got 4 users here running Ubuntu.
5.
I mean, so it's definitely...
5 people. Okay.
Yeah, it's definitely 6. You run Ubuntu? Okay, so we got 6 people.
Okay.
So it's it's not too late. It's just they're not part of the dialogue. That's all. So many last fans. Seriously. The Linux Action Show freaking rocked Linux Fest Northwest this year. We have an army here with us, and it literally became ridiculous and absolutely amazing at the same time. Like, when we would get up and go places, we create an entire blockage. Like,
it's like a gravity field. It really was awesome.
When we were at the Radio Museum, I kept moving around because wherever we would go, there would be, like, no way for anyone to get around us.
Right.
Like, we would totally consume an entire area of the museum. So lots of Lass and JB shirts here. So that's really cool. Lots of folks came in from all over, not just local. So that's really neat. And I think it's been one of those things where I've walked away from it sort of, it feels like it's a bit of a turning point for the fest, and also a bit of a turning point for the show. It's a kind of, I think a lot, we've grown as the fest has grown.
Coming of age, maybe.
Linux is growing. Yeah, exactly. So in a way, I feel like it's sort of the mark of a new beginning for Linux Fest.
Sure.
It's sort of an era of where everyone is welcome. You could be Microsoft. You could be a hardware solution guy. You're a maker with a 3D printer. You're an idealist who has a vision for something that could be done in the future. And even the BSD jerks. Everybody is welcome. Everybody can work together.
That Alan guy, you got to watch him, man.
I'm looking over at the booth, too, when I say it, because some of them over there are watching live now.
Yeah.
And I tell you, that is surprisingly refreshing, yeah. And it's nice and laid back, and that is kind of amazing in the era now of events that are so commercialized, so let's sell you something driven. You know, so many of the tech events have really gone to crap.
Oh, but yeah.
This one is still grassroots and awesome, so there's that. Linux Action Show definitely saw people come from all over the world. We packed that Spark Museum. We packed it so tight, they had to show the Tesla coil in shifts because they couldn't fit everybody in there, so they had to do it in rotations. While we can't claim credit for all of it, it's awesome to be part of the harmony of events that has brought everybody together here. Definitely. Linux Fest Northwest, I think, should be looked at as a model, not just for all open source related conferences, but I think the industry as a whole could take elements from this conference and incorporate it into larger events to sort of bring them back down to the ground a little bit, make them a little more real, because when they're real, actual work gets done, mm-hmm. actual connections are made, and it's worth your time.
I think so. I think it's definitely shown that despite its growth, it hasn't lost its grassroots stuff.
Right.
It's free to get in. Really burn that in your head for a minute. I've been to a lot of tech conferences that are starting $500 mm-hmm. or higher, forget it.
And it's managed to do that. It's managed to keep that genuineness about it, that funness, that chill nature about it, while we're also talking with Red Hat and those things, too. So it's been really a really great conference. I've really enjoyed being here. I can't wait till next year.
Definitely.
And we have a great guest who's sitting down with us. Mr. John Mad Dog Hall. Very great. Hello, Mr. Mad Dog. Thank you for joining us on the Linux Action Show. Did you just get back from a session? Well, I appreciate you. I have to take that for you. I appreciate you joining us very much.
Yes.
So what's your impression of Linux Fest? I know this isn't your first Linux Fest, is it?
No. I've been to several of the Northwest Linux Fests. Of course, I go to other Linux Fests around the world. Mm-hmm, so. Mm-hmm. I've been to quite a few.
Right, absolutely. So I kind of want to, we have a live stream watching, and I think they'd be kind of curious to know, what was it? Because people have heard your name a lot. But there's a couple of things that I think are missing in sort of the story for me, and I'm curious, I'd like to ask you, could you talk a little bit about originally kind of becoming associated with Linux, why you wanted to become involved with the Linux community and those kinds of aspects that attracted you to it?
Well, first of all, you have to understand where I came from as a programmer. I started programming in 1969, and in that time, there were very few professional programmers. In fact, I had a professor of mine at university told me that I would never make a living as a professional programmer.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Because people who wrote programs were people who needed the software for their own purposes. So, for example, you went to work for an insurance company, you were an insurance person, and you wrote programs for insurance, right? There was no market for shrink-wrap software.
Right.
And there was relatively few companies that wrote software for other people.
Right.
Okay? So, it was, you know, and when you wrote, and because there were so many different computer systems of so many different architectures, there was no real market for a shrink-wrapped version of code, because if you went to the trouble of making that, you'd only sell 15 or 20 copies to various people.
Right.
So the real market for shrink-wrapped came around the time of CPM, microcomputers, things like that. They were being manufactured in large numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Some people did create binary-only copies, but they would typically do that by showing up with a magnetic tape that had the source code on it, put it on your system, compile it, and then take the tape away.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So all through my life, I was used to having the source code. I either worked for a very large company that demanded the source code, would have the source code, and we even had the source code for the MVS operating system, and we had the source code for compilers and source code for databases, and we could change it as we needed it. Or I worked for a university where we basically wrote our own programs or had the students write them or things like that. Or I worked for a very large company, Digital Equipment Corporation, that made its own software. And
so for you, it was very odd not to have the source.
Exactly. Exactly. Although I did run into people at Digital who had come into computers after I did, and they were kind of used to having binary-only software. And I had trouble explaining to them why people really needed the source code.
Right.
So I met Linus Torvalds in May of 1994, and when I saw Linux for the first time, we had just come out with the Alpha processor. It was a 64-bit system. It was a RISC computer instead of a SYS computer.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw as something that we might be able to use Linux to get interest in doing research for very large address spaces and how you would use them. So if you're ever familiar with Don Knuth's Art of Computer Programming,
mm-hmm.
Volume number 3 is Searching and Sorting Techniques. I have about 4 different editions of Don's book as he rewrote it over the years.
I'm sure,
As the addresses kept getting larger. And, you know, the algorithm that was very useful in a 16-bit system was less useful for a 32-bit system and really made no sense at all in a 64-bit system and vice versa.
Yeah.
So I wanted to see that type of research being done, but yet I also knew that it's better to do the research where you could take the research and distribute it in source code form.
Mm.
Because, yes, you could write up your thing that you did, and then somebody else would duplicate mm-hmm. your source code mm-hmm. and try and get it right. But that was a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easier just to say, well, here's the write-up I did. Oh, by the way, here's a sample source code I did.
Right.
You can stick that in.
Yes.
And you can see exactly what I did
yes.
and why it works.
Right.
And you can tweak it.
Right.
And so I saw Linux on the Alpha, or actually on the Intel system.
Okay.
And I said, Linus, had you ever thought about, you know, taking Linux and putting it on a 64-bit system?
How did you respond to that?
Oh, yes. I've thought about that. But, you know, it's been very hard for the people in digital in Helsinki to get me that Alpha system. So I may have to do an IBM PowerPC instead.
Right.
I you know, and it didn't take much to realize that was the wrong answer. Okay,
yeah.
So I quickly went back to Digital Equipment Corporation, and I found a friend of mine who owed me a few favors, and I said, we have to get this Alpha system to Helsinki, Finland right away, and
it's really important.
Don't have the time to tell you.
How did you know, though? What sense did you have that how important that was? Was it just a gut feeling? Because it seems like a lot of effort for, at that time, not a very popular operating system, or a kernel even.
That's true. But what happened was, well, first of all, there was a guy named Kurt Riesler, and actually his brother is here at this fest today.
Oh, wow.
And Kurt was the president of the Linux Special Interest Group for DECUS. And it was Kurt who had found out about this project and was very determined to get this person to come from Europe.
And he had your ear?
And yes, because Kurt was a very good guy.
Yeah.
And he had a lot of good ideas and stuff. He was kind of a little unusual, and you know, as most
right.
geeks are.
Yes.
And but he was very, you know, he kept trying to get money to bring this person from Europe to DECUS. And he kept sending messages out, and these people kept saying, well, you know, I'd like to help you out, but we don't have very much money. We have a lot of CDs we can give you.
Right.
And I felt bad for Kurt because he was a good guy. And so I went to my management, and I said, you know, I don't know who this guy is or what he did, but, Kurt sometimes has good ideas. I think we should fund this.
Wow.
And my management went to their management and said, we don't know who this guy is or what he does, and we don't even know who Kurt is, but Mad Dog sometimes has good ideas. So we should fund this.
Of course. Safe bet.
And so we got $5,000 to buy this person an airline ticket to, you know, to New Orleans that year.
Wow.
And some money for the hotel room and things like that. And then Kurt asked the thing that was really... really pissed me off.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
Because he asked for an Intel PC to run this software on.
Oh.
And I go, Kurt, I mean, I have VAXes, I have MIPS chips, I have Alpha systems and stuff, and you want me to get you one of these weak, miserable,
crappy Intel
PCs to run this code on,
right.
you know?
Yes.
Now, you remember, this is 1994, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And no, we need this. So I went out. This is extra money for my group. You know, get this thing, send it down there to DECUS. And so I go down to DECUS, and here's Kurt trying to install this software onto the system, not having very much luck. And all of a sudden, there comes this guy, sandy brown hair, wire-rimmed glasses, white socks with sandals.
Thank you.
Sandals. Can I help you? And Kurt looks at him and says, I think you can. And about 10 minutes later, Linux is running on his system.
Wow.
This was the first time that Linus Torvalds had ever installed Linux off of a CD.
Wow.
Because the way he installed Linux was he would build the package on a second disk and then boot that second disk to have it installed on the first one. That's the way he did testing of installation. So they invited me to sit down and use it. And when I did, I experienced this thing. Okay. Now, I collect automated musical instruments. Mm-hmm. I collect player pianos, player reed organs, Nickelodeons, things like that. And when you play a piano, if a piano is tuned, you can get fairly decent music out of it. But if it's a really great piano, all the keys are perfectly lined up, and all the keys are weighted perfectly. And, you know, you play it, and it's just a joy to play that instrument, okay?
Yeah.
Well, by this time, I'd used Berkeley Unix. I'd used System 3, System 4, System 5. I'd used Xenix. I'd used Solaris. I'd used Alteryx, Digital Unix. And when I started to play with this keyboard, I realized if I thought of this as System 5, it seemed like it was System 5. If I thought of this like, you know, Berkeley, it seemed like it was Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And this weak, miserable, crappy Intel PC was responsive to this. And I said, this is pretty amazing. And it's, you know, version 1.0 of the kernel. It was done by a university student, you know, with a bunch of other people. And I listened to Linus's two talks he gave. Each talk attracted 40 people. Now, at that year, there were 19,000 people at Deacus.
Oh, okay.
His talk only attracted 40.
It gives it some perspective.
Whoa. In 1999, 5 years later, they had the first Linux World in Santa Clara.
Yeah.
6,000 people were lined up waiting to hear Linus give his talk.
Wow, that happens so fast when you look back in retrospect like that. How important do you think it is to sort of keep that early culture in our resident memory as a sense as a community?
I think it's very important, and I think that, you know, it's I don't expect that everybody is going to have that type of thing, because in a huge group of people that are using free software, you're going to find people that are just using free software as a tool.
Sure.
And just like they use Microsoft software as a tool, right? And they really don't care.
Right.
All they want is it works, it scales, it's things like that. But I think it's very important that you have a core group of people who want to see it better.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And the interesting part is when you talk with Linus and some of the people from the early days of the Linux kernel, their concept was not to create a kernel that was free of charge. Their concept was not to create a system that was even the universal freedom. But their concept was to create a better operating system. They wanted something that was better than the stuff that came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's an interesting thing, okay? You know, the fact, you know, whether or not they had to pay for it, whether or not it was free, as in freedom,
well,
that was less.
I can see that, yeah. I switched to Linux in the server space because it was better. And then I learned about open source and all of that. So I can see that.
Right. So, but, you know, but then there were people who felt very strongly about the freedom part.
Yeah.
And we actually had people leave the group because certain things happened. They didn't agree with certain things in the philosophy of the system. And they left the Linux place. And that was sad, but...
Yeah. Probably in a large group. Kind of happens, though.
Yeah,
especially as growth is happening.
You can't expect everybody to agree with everything.
Yeah. So looking back at that now, here we are in 2014. Has it met expectations? Has the community and Linux and its growth and its adoption exceeded? Where do you fall down on that? Do you think we still have a lot of growth to do? And do you think there's areas we have big improvement to be made?
And there's some new challenges that are coming out. Okay.
What are you worried about there?
I'm worried. I am frightened, terrified of the Internet of Things. Okay? There's a lot of companies, very large companies, who just see dollar signs in that.
Yes.
And they are the ones who are creating these smart TVs. Right. But it's smart TVs as long as it runs. It's their hardware and their software.
Right,
okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so when I try and get my Frigidaire refrigerator to talk to my Ramada radar range oven, you know, they don't talk.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think this is a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But the Internet of Things is even worse, because here we're going to generate billions of little sensors out there. Each one of them is going to be intelligent and be able to connect to some type of wireless service to do this.
And send data back.
Or they could be turned into a botnet. Okay.
Yeah.
And a really strong botnet.
Right.
And what happens if the company that created them is now out of business and you can't get the patch that's going to stop them from being that botnet?
Right. Yep. Right. Yeah, it's out of your hands.
Exactly. And that is the type of thing that really frightens me a lot.
Okay. What can we do sitting, you know, realistically as open source users and Linux advocates? What tools are available to us?
Well, first of all, you can make people aware of these issues. You can continue to work with your governments, your companies, and things like that. Continue to press the open source message and why it's important. But make sure you're doing it for the right reason. It is not the cost. I mean, the cost is, it's nice that a lot of the software that's free software, In a lot of ways, the cost is minimal.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no such thing as completely free of cost.
Well, and don't you think in this Internet of Devices age, where they're subsidizing the cost by monitoring and tracking and getting data like Google does, that cost argument is quickly going away completely, because they're also lowering their costs because they're getting the money, the profit from app sales or monitoring you. So in a way, like, the ability to say, well, it's free, it's pretty much going to be null, because almost everything is going to be free because they want you to use it, don't you think?
Well, actually, this has been going on for a number of years, because I do a lot of work in Latin America, and the piracy rate, the software piracy rate in Brazil, for example, is 84%.
Wow.
Okay? The software piracy rate for desktop PCs in Vietnam is 96%.
Oh, my goodness.
Whoa.
So when I talk to them about you should use free software, they kind of smile and they say,
already.
Oh, Mad Dog, all of our software is free, right?
and so
I have two arguments back to them, okay? So number one is, yes, it's free, but in reality, you know, you're still violating what somebody else wanted for that software.
Right. Yeah.
But I've stopped talking about that and stressing the freedom part of it.
Okay.
Okay. Not the gratis part, but the freedom part.
Right.
And stressing to why that freedom is very important for them. Okay. But the second thing is, I stopped talking about cost altogether. And what I talk about now is return on investment. Because, okay, if you can't afford something, obviously you can't choose that as a solution. But after you've chosen the solution, the next thing you should be looking for is, what is the return on your investment? You're going to invest time in something. You're going to invest money in something. And, you know, can you make more money out of something else? Now, the fact that free software can be changed to meet your situation and be fit more of a glove gives it a greater return on investment than the proprietary software.
Right.
And I have a whole series of examples of that. Another thing is that, okay, first of all, nobody buys software as a product, really, okay? You don't have a box of software that you stick up on your wall with candles on either side. You create a shrine to it. You know, you bow to it every day. You don't do that.
Right.
Okay?
No.
And you don't buy hardware for that either.
Right.
What you do is you're buying a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Where that solution is playing war, you know, World of Warcraft, or where that solution is running a database to run your business, you're buying a solution.
Right.
Okay. So you have to say to yourself, can I get a better solution through the use of free software? Because I have the source code, I can change it to meet my needs. Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing. And a lot of times, that solution is a secondary to you.
Right.
So I knew a man who ran a thing called a turbine test bed. It tested steam turbines, and he used all free software to run his turbine test bed. But he was not the customer. The customer was actually engineers who had designed the turbine, and they were simply using his turbine test bed to test out their design.
Right.
So they would ask him, could you make this small change to your software? And he says, oh, sure, I could do that, and I could do it overnight. Well, his competitors were four turbine test beds that used proprietary software.
Interesting.
And any little change to that meant that you had to wait 10 months for the company that made that software to make the change. Yep. So who got the better service? The person who is the customers who were using the free software because the guy could do the change overnight.
Right.
So you have to look sometimes at secondary and tertiary examples. Okay. I think one thing that's happening right now is Windows XP.
Right.
Oh, boy.
There's a lot of people out there who want to use Windows XP, are desperate to keep using Windows XP.
Exactly.
They love using Windows XP, but they can't.
They're out of options.
It's a solution for them still, though.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is another thing. I've in a lot of cases, I know Richard's going to hate me for saying this, I've given up talking about software freedom, and I start talking about software slavery.
Hmm.
Interesting.
Because
okay.
I think it's pretty obvious that in the last several years, some people are confused about what freedom means, right?
Yeah.
And they think, oh, I got this freedom to do this or freedom to do that. Well, do you? You know, I mean, your freedom ends when my arm is at your nose, okay?
Right.
Yes.
And or your arm is at my nose. So I stopped talking about that, and I started talking about slavery because people have a better image of what a slave is.
Right, that conjures up some strong emotions. And
well, it's not only strong emotions, but you've seen enough. So a slave is told where to go, what to do, who to marry, when to have children. They own nothing.
Right.
You know, it's all owned by the master.
Sure.
And that's what slavery is about.
Makes sense.
And when you're a software slave, you don't own the software. It's owned by the master. You're told when to upgrade. You're told how many people could use it.
What to run on.
What machines to go on and stuff like that.
Right.
And you have no choice as to what it is.
So true.
There's another thing. I don't talk to business people about the glory of being able to look at the source code, stuff. I talk about control because business people want to have control.
Right.
That's what they want. They want to have control over their business. They want to be able to know they can do something at a certain time.
Especially if it's core to their business, right?
Exactly. Okay. So I talk about control, not choice.
Right.
Choice terrifies business people unless it's their choice.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they have control.
Right. Yeah.
Right, right. Exactly.
Sure.
So these are the ways I've changed my messages, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing this for several years now.
Mm-hmm.
Fine-tuning it as I go along.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you very much for stopping by and chatting with us. It was very good to get to chat with you. It's been years since I've seen you, so I really appreciate
it. Awesome.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. And would you like a challenge coin? Would you like one of our show coins?
Oh, sure.
There you go, sir. And you can have a sticker, too, if you like one.
Oh, I was just looking at the stickers.
We make them each year for Linux Fest. Yeah. So if you're here next year, make sure you grab another one. You get one for each year.
Yeah, very nice. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You.
Thanks
we
for coming
it.
On. All right. Well, that'll wrap up our Linux Fest Northwest segment. Now we're going to get to the giveaways, Matt.
Nice.
So stay tuned.
Woo.
And that brings us to the end of this week's broadcast. But hey, Matt,
yes.
Before we get out of here, I want to point folks at some of the cool things you've been doing this week. I know that you've got a new Geek in the Gamer out, right?
We do. We got a Broforce Part 2. This time there's even more screaming and yelling into microphones. And you should definitely check that out, especially if you want to see things explode.
Yeah.
So we got plenty of that going on.
This is fun. I think it's really neat that you guys do this. And some folks in the subreddit have been enjoying it, too. And you've also got some articles over at Datamation.
At Datamation. If you've not already read the Why I Switched to GNOME, be sure to check that out.
Very good. I'm going to read that when we get home tonight. I just want to give another plug for TechSnap. If you've been enjoying the Heartbleed coverage, go watch 160. It'll come out this week. Also,
Big thank you to our buddy, Mr. Chase, running the board all week at all weekend at Linux Fest Northwest. Go check out geekgamer.tv for his shows, and also go watch Unfilter, where he co-hosts that show
with
me. Go get some more Chase in your face. Hey, that kind of rhymes.
That's
kind of
cool.
That.
Couldn't do it without
No.
So thank you, Chase. Thanks for helping us out this weekend.
Appreciate it.
No flawless victory. Now that we're not actually done yet, I shouldn't probably say that. So,
yeah,
knock on wood.
Yeah.
Somebody.
Dunk.
Okay. All right. So first thing I want to give away is we have the very last.
Oh, my goodness.
The final.
Oh, my.
TechSnap 100 t-shirts.
This is collector's item stuff, folks.
No more of these left.
This is like, it's there or it's gone.
All right. So we're going to give it out by size. So raise your hands if you want this size, okay? You right? Because we've got
three sizes. As soon as we figure out what size that is.
Yeah, as soon as I find it. This is... What's G? Large. This is large. Who wants a large TechSnap 100 shirt? Large? All right, there you go, sir. Large shirt for you. All right. This is extra large. Who wants an XL TechSnap 100 shirt? Going once, going twice, and winner. Okay. Now we have extra, extra large. Who wants an extra? This is triple X large. Anybody want a triple? All right, Mr. 2040, you got it.
Lost
there you
it.
Go. Okay. Now, who doesn't have a coin?
Who needs a challenge coin?
Who needs a challenge coin?
Challenge
Brian,
coin.
You have a coin.
Challenge coin.
All right, Brian, coin.
Coin? Okay.
Anybody else
who
want
wants
a coin?
A coin? Coin in your forehead.
Coin.
Wham.
Yeah, there boom. You want a coin? You got a coin?
Coins?
I know you got more coins. Here you go. Here's a coin. Anybody
okay,
else
you
want
to,
a coin?
Okay.
Woo! Whoop. And another one. Woo!
Launching
there you go.
Coins.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm going to start throwing them at random walking passerbyers. There we go. Now we're going to start throwing books.
You.
This one gets real.
Absolute BSD.
Don't forget the D.
Open
That's
BSD.
Important.
Not just regular BSD. Yeah. Open BSD. Anybody here fancy themselves a little BSD trivia? What is the firewall built in to open BSD?
Ooh.
You got it. All right, here you go.
Ding,
you're the
ding,
winner.
Ding, ding,
you got it, buddy. Good job.
You lost it.
PS.
Nice job.
All right. Now, this book, we interviewed the author on TechSnap.
Yes.
This applies to Linux. This is really good to learn how to monitor what the F is going on with your Linux install,
mm-hmm.
what the performance metrics are, and things like that. Anybody around here do any sysadmin work? Anybody? Sysadmin work? Here you go, Mr. 2040. You win. Boom. All right. Now we get to the Jupiter Broadcasting shirts. We're not giving all these away.
No.
Because I got some people that I set some aside for.
Yes, yes.
Anybody not have a Jupiter Broadcasting t-shirt?
JB t-shirt. Or JB
All right, here's
shirt.
One for you, sir.
Got
Make sure
one down
that's the
here.
Right size. You can exchange it if it's not.
Yep.
All right.
Over here.
Here you go, sir.
You go.
Boom. Mr. 2040. You can exchange these if you guys
All
need
right.
to.
I've got a couple more shirts to go out. Anyone else not need a JB shirt? You got a JB shirt
Boom.
Right here? You got one? You need one?
Anybody else need a JB?
Right here. There we go.
Bumsies. All right, guys. Thank you very much for showing up. This has been a very fun Linux Fest Northwest. We've got some more balloons and stuff you guys can grab and more stickers. Make sure everybody gets a sticker before they go. All right?
Yeah, okay. Very important.
And before we wrap up, I just would like to invite you to join us live next week. We do the Linux Action Show every single Sunday over at jblive.tv. We do it at 10 a.m. Pacific, but you can go to jupiterbroadcasting.com/calendar to get that converted in your own time zone. Yeesh. And we'd also like to get your feedback. Over to jupiterbroadcasting.com, click the contact link, and choose Linux Action Show from the dropdown. And don't forget about Linux Unplugged, our unplugged Linux podcast. We do it every single Tuesday.
That's right.
And we have actually got to meet some of the folks in our virtual lug this weekend.
It's like
so
cool. real life our IRC handles. It's really cool. And don't forget our subreddit, too.
Right.
Subreddit.
LinuxActionShow.reddit.com. Whoop, whoop.
Whoop, whoop.
All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much for tuning this week's episode of the Linux Action Show. We'll see you right back here next week.
Bye-bye.
Pre-flight checks. We're good for go. All the board clear. 5x5 for broadcast.
Everybody know where the emergency exits are and about the
please pack and
hey,
store
good
your.
Good morning, everybody. It's your captain speaking. We'll be flying at an altitude of 35,000 feet. Our cruising time today to Seattle will be just under 1 hour. I just want to say thank you for flying with us. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the flight. Your flight attendants, prepare for departure.
I was just,
people love Ting, and you're people.
Yeah, because people love Ting.
There you go.
And you're people, aren't you? What, are you not a person?
Yeah.
What's the matter with you?
What's wrong with your peoples? Yeah, you're not. You're just.
I got a bad horn again? The horn is.
You know, it's there. It's
Weren't
okay.
Aren't you just telling me not to look at the chat room, and now you're looking at the chat room?
It's okay to have limp horn. There are people out there that can help you with this.
I just,
there's medicine.
It's just starting
there's
to be
treatment.
A trend, dude. I had the limp hat. Now I have a limp horn.
wait a minute. It's just stopped.
You know,
this is what's happening.
Limp what?
I feel like somebody really smart is trolling me every time I go on air with some sort of.
They gave you
prop.
A limp horn on purpose.
And I get a limp horn. Yep. Maybe they did. Could the IX Systems guys be so clever that they picked one limp
remote
horn,
control,
one limp horn, one and like give that one to Chris?
Hey, man.
Give Chris the limp horn.
Ram Rob.
What do you guys think of Dubstep Linux Fest?
Whoa, 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 who